This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. This morning, we're hearing about telehealth and falconry.
Yeah, there's many times I wish I could be up there just flying around. It'd be really cool.
That's coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. The coronavirus has driven many routine medical appointments online, accelerating a trend toward telemedicine that's been underway. WVU Medicine, one of the largest health providers in the state, saw about 15,000 telehealth visits a year. At the start of the crisis, though, they invested about $2 million to ensure every physician across their entire system was equipped with the computers and network technology to make telehealth work. In a recent episode of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's program, Us and Them, host Trey Kay spoke with WVU Medicine's chief financial officer, Doug Kaufman, about how the pandemic exploded telehealth use to levels that otherwise would have taken years to achieve.
We actually went from, I think, about 1,000 of those encounters in February to over 50,000 in the month of April. At the beginning, we had physicians that weren't comfortable doing it. We had patients that weren't comfortable doing it. And by the middle of May, that completely flip-flopped. And so, like I said, it probably sped up the introduction of telemedicine in the state of West Virginia by at least 5 years. I think one of the things that became apparent during this crisis, and this is something that will really be dependent on the politicians in Charleston and Washington, is the emphasis on broadband has to improve. You can't rely on virtual visits in West Virginia if you don't have the connectivity.
Okay, so you're making telehealth available and trying to lobby for more connectivity in the state, but will you be closing brick and mortar facilities? You know, is that the kind of business bottom line that maybe some people might see in the future?
You could. I can't point to a specific location or example of that right now, but I think down the road, for us, it's about our goal of eventually lowering that cost of care. I think everybody will admit healthcare in the United States is 20% of GDP. That, in most people's opinion, is not sustainable. And so part of our long-term strategic plan is how do we lower that cost of care? And telemedicine and virtual visits is a way to do that.
The cost of healthcare is too high. Americans spend more on healthcare than most other advanced countries. In 2018, the average cost was $11,000 per person. The Brookings Institution reports that a third of all healthcare spending is paid to hospitals. Another quarter of that pie goes to clinics for outpatient care. That's what makes healthcare such a big business, and why it's now so vulnerable when patients don't show up. The jobless rate in the U.S. is about 10%. That's 30 million people out of work. In July alone, 4 million people filed for unemployment. Since health insurance is tied to employment, nobody can afford to get sick. And even post-COVID, when people can go back to the doctor, will they? It will take time for people's trust and for the economy to recover. This suggests that rural hospitals and healthcare systems that rely on private insurance are headed for continued losses. I asked Doug Kaufman what this could mean for a big player like WVU Medicine. For years, it's been expanding its footprint throughout the northern part of the state.
Our approach has been on a collaborative basis. In other words, in the rural places we've gone, I'll use Summersville for example. Summersville was struggling. They were on one day's cash on hand. We didn't go into Summersville to put Summersville out of business. We went into Summersville to help them be successful and provide care for that community. West Virginia only has 1.8 million people in the state. And towns like Summersville, Braxton County, Jackson General, you know, those hospitals can't put specialists in those small towns. But what they can do is rely on us and refer those patients to our specialists when they're needed. And that creates the patient base that our physicians need so that we can become that patient hub.
Well, Let me put it to you this way, Doug. I mean, I guess one of the things that I'm hearing worry and concern about is that if a large institution like WVU Medicine were to expand its footprint into a place that maybe has, you know, a small hospital, maybe a community healthcare system, and they would see this institution moving in as competition, and that more people would flock to that, and maybe eventually these community healthcare systems would basically dry up, maybe go away.
Yeah, that's not our model. I don't think of the 11 hospitals that are part of our system, you could point to a single one of those that we did that. In the ones that we've put services in, we've done it where the community has asked us to and where the need has existed.
I just want to push on this one thing. The negative would be if the larger institution was to move into the area and then eventually if you would consider those other people competition, they go away. It's almost kind of like a Walmart moving in.
I agree.
And then eventually Walmart does a reassessment. And you know, it's the store here in Tucker County is losing money. Let's just pull it out. And then all of a sudden you're in a kind of a...
Then there's a hole.
A hole and a desert.
Yeah. We're not looking to supplement what they already have or replace what they've already had. We're looking to make what they have better. And I think we do that by having the access to specialists and the technology that they don't have access to.
What might we be missing here as we're kind of like looking at that dynamic tension of rural, urban, and are most West Virginians getting the healthcare they need?
It's a good question. It's a fair question. I think our current healthcare system is flawed, and it is very hard for independent operations to survive just because of the dynamics involved with physicians, with technology, with legal, with compliance. That we can share those infrastructure costs among our health system. Whereas if you're an independent operator, that falls on your shoulders. And so our healthcare financing system makes it very hard for the independent provider or independent hospital to survive long term. And so that nature of being able to react with scale and economy is very important.
That was Chief Financial Officer of WVU Medicine, Doug Kaufman, in an excerpt of the latest episode of our show, Us and Them, titled Forced Apart, The Delicate and Crazy Dance of American Healthcare. To hear the rest of the show, download Us and Them wherever you get your podcast or listen online at wvpublic.org. This episode of Us and Them is presented with support from the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation and the West Virginia Humanities Council. The sport of falconry is the oldest form of hunting, dating back to 5000 BC in Mongolia. Some historians say people may have been bonding and partnering with birds of prey even longer than that. But not just anybody can become a falconer. You have to take a test, which includes making sure you know how to take care of the bird. And you have to be an apprentice with a master falconer for several years first. Here in West Virginia, there are 31 people with falconry licenses. Roxy Todd spoke with one of them, 20-year-old Colin Waybright, who lives in Randolph County.
To be a falconer, you have to love birds. Like, really love birds. You can tell by the way Colin Waybright talks about birds with such admiration and affection that he fits the bill.
The way I got started is I went to a Hunt and Fishing Day celebration at Stonewall Resort. I saw this raptor display and I thought it was just amazing.
Colin became a falconry apprentice when he was 14 years old. And get this, first thing you need to do when you become a falconer is trap your own young bird in the wild.
So actually the typical way that falconry works is you trap a young bird in juvenile plumage and train it.
So in the middle of January, 6 years ago, Colin trekked out in the snow to try to catch a young red-tailed hawk. He remembers sub-zero temperatures and leaving a rabbit as bait in a Swedish goshawk trap. He went to check the trap the next day.
Had my mom come down with me, and we went down, and it was dark, and the trap was shut. We're like, oh, what in the world did I catch? You know, because you never know what you're going to catch. You could catch an owl, a hawk, something like that. Well, we drove up, and this was the first bird I had caught, and it was a juvenile red-tailed hawk. Out of all the birds that I could have caught for the first time in that trap, it was what I was after. And that is just amazing to me to this day.
He named that red-tailed hawk Ace. He loved that bird. Colin spent like all his time training Ace and hunting with Ace. His mom says they were nearly inseparable. Falconry requires forming a strong bond with a bird of prey. Hawks aren't motivated to hunt on command. They hunt for the same reason a hawk does in the wild, because they're hungry. That means a falconer has to keep close tabs on their bird's weight, making sure they don't get overfed, but also stay healthy. Colin taught Ace calls so they could communicate in the woods. Here's a recent hunt Colin did with another bird. That's a typical sound a falconer makes to signal to their hawk that an animal they're hunting is getting away. In this case, a gray squirrel. The hawk knows through training to watch their human, well, like a hawk, to gauge where the squirrel is. Colin will walk through fields and forest, and the bird follows, flying from treetop to treetop, scanning for prey. They hunt together like this, but the birds really do most of the work. Colin usually lets his hawks eat the prey after they kill it. He got very attached to his first bird, Ace. They hunted together like this, just the two of them. In the wild, half of hawks die in their first year. If they survive past that, hawks typically live another 9 or so years. But if a falconer is feeding them, they can live for up to 3 decades. Colin's hawk, Ace, wasn't so lucky.
Ace ended up passing away in the second season I flew him. He was fine one day, doing some training. Then the next day he was acting a little bit slow. Next day there was clearly something wrong. Called the Raptor Center.
The West Virginia Raptor Rehabilitation Center in Fairmont advised Colin, trying to determine what was wrong with Ace.
And the next day he had passed away. So that's one of the hardest things ever.
Colin says the veterinarians told him Ace probably died from a genetic disease. Colin says losing Ace like that, so suddenly, was the toughest thing he's faced as a falconer. Since then, he's trained 8 birds of prey. Like most falconers, he loves watching the birds hunt. But even more than that, he just loves watching them fly. At times, it's like he vicariously gets to fly himself.
I definitely have wished quite a few times that I could fly. I mean, you see the hawks and you see all the other birds doing it as well, and they all have different flight styles, and it's amazing. But the flight style that's probably the most just fun to watch is the vultures. They're just so effortless. They can just soar on thermals, and whenever it gets a little windy, they just kind of tuck their wings back a little bit and go into it, and it's just amazing to watch them. Yeah, there's many times I wish I could be up there just flying around. Be really cool.
Another one of Colin's favorite parts of the work is giving presentations to kids.
I ask them questions as I'm talking to them, and their reactions to the questions are just priceless. I'll look at them, the group, and ask, you know, how much do you guys think this bird weighs? And I'll get guesses from 20 to 100 pounds. It's just funny whenever you say, well, no, this guy only weighs about 2 to 3 pounds, and then the jaws drop, you know.
Most of these public talks have been put on hold during the pandemic, but Colin says he does offer informal demonstrations at his family's farm, where his mother also manages a bed and breakfast. And one day, he says, if someone approaches him with the right passion for learning falconry, he'd consider taking them on as an apprentice. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd.
You can see a photo of Colin and some of the birds he's trained on our website. There, you can also watch a video of Master Falconer Mick Brown with his bird named Purdy. That's all at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Andrea Billups is our news director. I'm your host and producer, Glynis Board. This is West Virginia Morning.